Stay tuned for The Lynn Show. Today, I'm airing an interview I did with Rick Kirby, who is the producing artistic director for the Manatee Players Theater in Bradenton, Florida. Rick's story, his journey from where he started to where he wound up, is not in any way typical. It's a series of surprises, or as Rick says, rides on a wave. Hang on, here come the show.
Hearing from an inner voice, finding choice where there's no choice, with gentle prodding from
is all about self-knowledge, knowing thyself. People have been talking about that for eons. For as long as there's been consciousness, we have been concerned about, interested in our knowledge of ourself. The remarkable thing to me as a psychotherapist in practice for, 35 years now, is that with this passionate interest and concern about who we are and what makes us tick and what's going on inside of us, and the emphasis of philosophers down the ages in self-discovery, with all of this emphasis, it is remarkable to me how few of us seem actually to know ourselves or to spend very much time trying to figure ourselves out, to actually know ourselves. What I hear more often, and this is not just in my practice, but, you know, in the world, is I want to be or I don't want to be. I'm trying to believe this. I want to be someone who. I don't want to be someone who this and that. And I don't want to do this. I don't want to think that. I don't want to believe this. I don't want to act this way. This is the opposite of the acceptance of self, the recognition of self, the awareness of self, or the knowledge of self. I spend a lot of time in my practice saying to people, you know, this thing about I really don't want to be this, I don't want to do this. You are what you are. Knowing who and what you are gives you an opportunity to make some choices about altering some things. But if you spend most of your time in denial for what you are, saying, I couldn't be that, and I don't want to be this, and I'm actually like this, all that energy, all that passion that goes into dissembling, pretending, is the opposite of actually knowing who you are. And the other thing that's so interesting to me is this idea that most of us seem to have that something about me is dreadful. Something about me is a flaw, a weakness, a bad thing. But, again, as I am often having to tell clients, you can't be anything that the rest of us are not. You can't be anything that human beings are not. If you're it, it's human, and pretty much everybody else has it too. So this desperate desire not to be jealous, or not to get angry, or not to get hurt, or not to laugh out loud, or not to be silly, or petty, or frivolous, or serious, or whatever it is you think you shouldn't be. This is a waste of time and energy. Yes, some qualities get us into trouble. And I think this is where all of this starts. If you've been listening to the show, you will have heard me talk about this a lot. And that is that in our childhood, there may very well have been a quality which is unacceptable to one or another of our parents, or both of them. Maybe you were brought up in a family that was that had a particular kind of religious belief system. The belief system that it is better to care for others than to care for yourself. That one must always sacrifice to the well-being, the benefit of others. That one must always essentially martyr oneself. And that is what the religion teaches, and that is what God wants, and that is what the good person is. Well, without making any judgments on any religion, which is not my job and I have no interest in doing, what I do believe is that all people have self-interest. That we are all at the mercy of what we believe that we need and want. And that cannot be amputated. Except perhaps for people like Mother Teresa. I mean, maybe Mother Teresa is the exception that proves the rule, and that there are people who are so evolved, to use that term, that they really have been able to separate their own needs without paying a price for it. Although I did hear a quote of Mother Teresa's, which I just loved. She said, apparently, I know that God never gives me more than I can handle, but I wish he didn't trust me this much. And this little joke speaks to human frailty. We are all fragile, frail, flawed, if you will. So, if you're raised in a family where the value is self-sacrifice, and as a result, you either completely deny your own needs, or you are constantly in turmoil over your need and your need not to pay attention to it, this is going to lead to difficulty. This is going to lead to resentment, internal struggle, conflict, and quite often physical and psychological distress. I get a lot of people in my practice whose problem is that they don't even know anymore what they want because they got so good at keeping a barrier between their wants and everybody else's needs. But they are paying the price. They're paying the price of depression, of migraine headaches, of apathy, of exhaustion, of just, well, that's enough. And when I say to them, well, you know, in this situation, what did you want? They quite often are quite puzzled. And they say, well, you know, I don't know what I want. I've never known what I wanted. And then I have to suggest that they go out and find a two-year-old. All two-year-olds know what they want. Every minute of every moment of every second, they know exactly what they want. We all came into life with a real strong sense of what we want. And it has to be taken away from us. We have to lose it. But we don't actually lose it. It just kind of goes underground, undercover is the term I'd like to use for it. And if you've heard me speak before, you know I'm talking about concepts in my book, When You Can, You Will, Why You Can't Always Do What You Want to Do and What to Do About It. And in that book I talk about how we place abilities, capacities, characteristics undercover, where we can't see them, so we can forget about them because they're troublesome and they get us into trouble. And all the qualities that for one reason or another are acceptable for us, they become our cover story. And it is part of the work I do to help people recover the qualities that they have had to place undercover. And you can get more information about that in my book or by continuing to listen to the shows, because I do talk about how to do that to some extent. And, oh yes, and my website, thelynnshow.com, thelynnshow.com, thelynnshow.com. And up there you can listen to the first chapter of the book or get the book or the workbook or the audio book. You can listen to my article on psychotherapy on the go, because I now do all of my private practice on the telephone. If you want to talk to me, you have a question or you have a comment, there's a place to email me, contact me, and if you email me, I will get back to you. And also, you can listen to all of the interviews that I do on the show, and that's what's coming up next. The other thing that I do on this show, besides talking about being an advocate for self-discovery, is I interview people who make their living or their life with an art. And as I always say, I do that because it's so damn hard to do in this culture. It has to be what you need to do, what you are, who you really are. And today's interview is no exception. This is Rick Kirby, who grew up in a place where it wasn't even the remotest possibility that he could become what he became. Yes, he liked to sing. Yes, his family was musical. Yes, he sang in chorus or choir. But the most he thought he could do with that was maybe teach, be a music teacher. And to his amazement, it turns out that there were many, many, many other things that he could be, and that they were all things so close to his heart, and at which he was so natural. So he grew up in a place like a plant in the wrong soil, you know, where you would think that he couldn't blossom, and yet he did. And it's a wonderful story, so which I'm going to let Rick tell you all by himself. And so now, here, the very sweet and articulate and multi-talented producing artistic director of the Manatee Players Theater in Bradenton, Florida, is Rick Kirby. So I am here with Rick Kirby of the Manatee Players Theater in downtown Bradenton. Mm-hmm. In my kitchen, because he was kind enough to come all the way down here and do this. It's great. Thank you. And Rick doesn't know anything about me or the show, so I'm going to tell him that I interview people who make their living or their life with an art. And I don't know what your title is. What is your title at the...
It's Producing Artistic Director.
Oh, yeah, you're the chief cheese, right?
On the artistic side.
On the artistic side, yeah. Yes. Producing Artistic Director at the Manatee Players. Mm. How long have you been?
I'm starting my 10th season. It's so hard. It went so quickly.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. They must like you.
I hope so.
So then clearly the art to which you have given at least the last 10 years is theater.
A lot longer than 10 years.
Yes. That almost always is. Yeah. So I only ask one question, and that is, how did it start? When was the very first moment in life when you thought acting, performing, stories, I like this, they like me? Do you know what I'm asking?
Right. Well, I grew up in a tiny little town in the middle of Appalachia, Kentucky, so getting to my career was not exactly a direct route. I come from a very musical family, and there was always my father sang, there was always musical instruments around with my brother, and so my first love was music, and I decided I was going to go to the local college, which was Eastern Kentucky University. I auditioned for a scholarship my junior year, so I knew I was going there early, and I got the scholarship, and one of the things they said is, when you get here, you're going to have to go through a dance audition, so just so you're prepared for that, and I get completely freaked out.
Okay, wait. I really want to hear this. And I want to go back, actually, I want to go back a little bit further.
Sure.
Music, mm-hmm. Does that mean singing?
I was a vocalist, yeah.
You're a vocalist, okay. And you said my father sang and my brother played instruments, but you didn't say anything about how you started to sing.
I just kind of always did. I mean, I think because my family was always so involved in music. Of course, it was country music, which I hated at the time.
You hated it?
Yes.
But you sang it? Or you sang something else? Or
I sang that and a lot of other things.
So how did you find this other stuff if you...
I would go to the library. I would
This suggests a really powerful interest. I mean, you're a young man in Appalachia, and you're going to the library looking for, I don't know what, show music, you know, rock and roll, right?
Musical theater.
Musical theater. Okay, so how did you find that? I mean, were they playing that in your house?
Oh, no.
This is very clearly, oh, no. Okay, so do you remember the first time you were experiencing a musical?
I remember hearing Sound of Music and South Pacific, those old sort of Rodgers and Hammerstein, probably through school, I think. We had this back in the days where they would go into the classroom with a cart and they would play an album for you, and that was your class music.
Really?
That you got.
Really?
And then maybe they gave you a flutophone that they dipped in alcohol, and then you passed it on to the next guy.
You're kidding. Really?
No, that was our music class.
Wow.
So that
so they would show up with the Sound of Music, you know, and you would hear, what's her name?
Oh, like Julie Andrews.
Julie Andrews, you know, singing that the hills are alive.
Right?
And did you think, wow, that's cute, that's pretty, that's interesting, I'd like to do that? Do you know what I mean?
Right. Well, I knew I liked it. I loved the idea that it was a story, and the songs kind of went with the story, and it all kind of fit together.
Right. So did they talk about... I mean, I don't have any idea. So they show up in class with the card, and they put the record on. Does that mean somebody told the story?
Yeah, they would kind of, they would lead you up to a point in the song, telling you what was happening. And then play the song, and they would talk you up to the next song that happened, or skip a few songs, and
right.
kind of give you a sense
right.
of...
So it was story time,
yeah,
as
exactly.
well as everything else,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
Right. Okay, so you found yourself drawn to this whole idea of songs telling stories, and
right.
like that, right? You, do you? I mean, you've mentioned these two. Are there any other ones that stand out?
When I got a little older, I started to like the Bob Fosse side of things,
Ooh.
You know, all that jazz and
Chicago. It would be very
cabaret,
late. Cabaret,
yeah.
right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, you know, it was such. And Pippin. Pippin was one of the first musicals I ever saw, and it was at one of the local colleges. And that's when I really fell head over heels, when I got to actually see it live performed.
And do you remember how old you were?
I was 15.
All right.
Yeah.
So this is growing thing. And they didn't do any plays in school? They didn't do any musicals? They didn't do
none,
any of that?
None. I mean, we had concerts, you know, but nothing.
Right.
No theater outlet at all, no.
So they're singing country music at home. They're playing country music at home. And you're getting this, you're getting intrigued or turned on or what, attracted mm-hmm. to this thing which you've got such a limited access to,
mm-hmm.
right? And yet, even in its limited form, it leaps out at
right,
you and
right.
says, "Woo, this, I like this," right?
Exactly.
Okay, and so did you learn these songs? I mean, did you start singing, you know, I don't know, Willkommen, you know?
Well, you had, that was the days of cassette tapes, so I went out and I bought a lot of cassette tapes, and I would play them over and over and over and
at
over
home?
And sing along with.
Right,
yeah.
right, right, right. At home, did anybody say, what the hell is that?
Yeah, my brother called it the long hair music. Why are you
oh.
listening to the long hair music?
Oh, how funny. Yeah, right. Well, yeah. Right. And so you got teased.
Yeah. Yeah, a little bit. Especially mm-hmm. for my brother. But,
who
I mean, that's
was
what older brothers are for.
Well, I think it's one of the things they do. I don't
right.
know that it's what they're for. But yeah. So was there anybody else at school interested in any of this?
Not the theater side so much, but I had a lot of friends who were interested in music and a lot of people through choir. I was also in the band and I studied music theory, and so all that circle of friends, we all kind of
right.
had that interest together.
Did you, what did you play?
A lot of things. I played the trumpet, the saxophone, xylophone, baritone.
Wow.
And I was the drum major too.
So, and your family approved of that?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah,
yeah. That was a big
yeah.
deal. Right. So did your parents notice that you were listening to long hair music, or they didn't care, or...
I think they just let me. They didn't really talk about it.
Right. He'll get over it.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, all right. So you decided. So now you had music theory and you played a lot of instruments. Did you have any voice lessons?
I did. I had some private lessons, and then I was lucky that I had a wonderful teacher in school who saw something in me early and kind of pulled me aside and really pushed me, and she was fabulous.
That's yeah. great and surprising, I think. Don't you?
Yeah, I think I there are a couple of those key people in my life, and she was the first who kind of said, you know, saw some spark in there that thought, you know, needed a little pushing and nurturing, and I owe a lot
to. And did she say, you know, what, I think you're talented, or are you thinking about, I don't know, what did she say? Do you remember?
Well, I remember it was my freshman year in high school, and she had just arrived there, and actually a band teacher from my middle school came to study hall and saw me sitting in study hall and was like, you don't need to be here, and pulled me into the chorus and introduced me to her.
So she was the chorus teacher?
She was the chorus teacher,
uh-huh.
yeah. And then sort of clicked there, and I think because music was one of those things that came easy to me, that
And you must have had a lovely voice, and she must have liked it.
Yes, it was raw, but I think that... You know, she at least saw that there was something to kind of grow there.
And how you felt about it.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. Okay. So, of the key people, is there anybody else in high school or just her?
I would say she was the main person who kind of drove me and helped me. in high school.
Okay, so now, maybe this is a stereotype and it's all wrong, but I can't... It seems to me that being a young man in Appalachia, falling in love with musical theater, it's not that common.
Oh, no.
Right. So you were lucky in that you could share your interest in music. You had friends mm-hmm. who would, you know, with whom you could talk about that and feel
right.
close to about that, but not a lot of people who were dying to go to New York and be in musicals.
Right, and I can't say that I never really thought it was a possibility to actually perform, you know, because
wow.
I had no example.
Right.
So I thought I was going to be a music teacher. That was my goal at that point.
How clever.
Mm-hmm. That was, you know, I could see people doing that and kind of model myself after that.
Right. Oh, that was very smart. That was very smart. So, okay, so now there you are. You have to audition in college and you're going to have to dance. Is that what you said? So, and I saw by the look on your face and what you started to say that this was not, you weren't jumping up and down saying, oh, goody.
No, I was scared to death. Mm-hmm. So I called the one and only dance teacher in my hometown, which is 3,000 people. So
oh
it's a tiny
God.
Little town. And her name was Erla True Robbins. And
Erla True?
Yeah.
Lovely.
Yes.
Very unusual. Right.
And she had a studio in her parents' basement. And I called her up and said, I want to take dance lessons, but only if you will not tell anyone, and only if I'm the only one person in the room. And she said, oh, sure, come on over. And I spent my own money that I mean, told my parents no one knew. I just went into the basement and danced with this lady. And again, for whatever reason, that came easy to me. I didn't even have to think about it. And I remember I used to laugh because I guess she had some sort of teaching books that she was teaching from.
Right.
So my very first lesson, she's like, Lord, honey, you done took me through book two. That's my favorite quote from her life. And then she would yell up the stairs for her mother to come watch me dance. And I, Mom, I come watch this boy dance. Come watch. And the door would open, and down would come her mother in her house coat and sit on the stairs and do these stupid little routines.
What were you doing? Was it like, was it tap or jazz?
Jazz.
So this was your first performance. This was your first audience.
For Mama Erla True, yeah, it was it.
That's great. It's a great scene. It's really a great scene.
Right.
Okay, so apparently you learned enough, I guess, right? So what did they have you do as an audition?
Well, everyone had to audition for the fall musical coming. I mean, everybody who was in the program, the music program, had to.
That's odd, don't you think? I mean, not everybody wants to dance.
Yeah. Well, I think they thought, well, at least we'll get somebody who's talented out of some
dance, right.
We'll get
somebody
who have a lot of options.
Right.
And I went to the audition, and coming as a freshman, incoming freshman, I got one of the leads in the show.
Because there weren't a lot of people, right, who had been training.
Exactly. Not a lot of people had private lessons from Erla True.
No, it's probably true. And what's so wonderful, really, is your certainty from very young that this was important to you, that you wanted to sing, that you wanted this. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
That you would reach out for it. I mean, my guess is you could count on your fingers anybody else in your town that who it would have occurred to buy these cassettes, who would have gotten it, you know, right? Okay, so what were you the lead in?
I got Riff in West Side Story.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
That's great.
Yeah, it was, I mean, it's unheard of. I mean, in most schools, especially the one I was going to, for an incoming unknown to get any sort of part, let alone a lead. But that was where I met my second mentor. His name was James Christian. He's actually teaching now in Utah. But again, saw something in me and said, you don't even know you're a dancer. Take this class, this one, this one, this one, this one. And kind of
so there was
redirected
dance,
my life.
Right?
Yeah.
So then there was dance in this school.
Yes.
Again, it was a music program.
I was on vocal scholarship. So I completely did a U-turn into musical theater, yeah.
Wow. And when he said that to you and you started to expand your idea of what you could do, Were you still thinking I'm going to teach music?
My first semester in college, that was my major, was
music education.
After that, I went to vocal performance in musical theater.
So by the time you were done with your first year, you understood that there was a career here that had nothing to do with teaching.
Yeah, it finally seemed like I can maybe do that.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
Yeah. And people there saying that you could. People there saying you should be, right?
Yeah.
So you made the turn from secure and predictable life to to that other thing.
Right.
The safe little cocoon place to the big city. So now you're in school, mm-hmm. and you're a vocal performance major. Is that, mm-hmm. was that mm-hmm. the title? Did your family know that you changed your major?
Eventually, yes.
But not right. Right. You didn't call them up and say, you know, I've decided.
Yeah, exactly.
Right, you know.
Yeah.
Oh, my. So, okay, so at some point before you graduated, you told them, or you didn't tell them?
Oh, no, they knew probably within the end of that year, I guess.
And how did they take it?
I have to say, my parents, I mean, they're simple farm folk, you know, and incredibly supportive. I mean, they had their disappointed moments with me, and I was definitely the oddball out of my family, but yet always proud of me, always kind of...
God bless them.
Yeah, every show I did, you know, they would be there sooner or later to come see it, so...
Did they like it? I mean, do you know, or did they... Because this was such a stretch for them.
Yeah. I think it depended on what I was doing.
My God.
But later, when I was performing... you know, I did Best Little House in Texas on tour, which is total opposite of every moral that they have.
That's right, exactly right.
And they hated the show, but they came to see it like 5 times because I was in it, you know.
Oh, good for them.
Yeah, and then I worked in Vegas, and they hated the Vegas thing, but yet they were there, you know. And
it's real interesting because it does seem like, this has come up a number of times, in especially with men, not so much with women, where a guy will just be like he got dropped in the wrong place,
mm-hmm.
you know? Like, he...
I used to feel that way.
Yeah, like right.
Something had gone wrong.
Wrong. Yeah,
why am I here?
Right, a stork made a big mistake.
Exactly.
You know, you should have been, right?
Right.
And it's not a completely unheard of story for me.
Right.
And quite often, remarkably... The rightness of the place shows up in the support that you get from family.
That's an interesting way to look at it. That's true.
You know, yeah. I mean, I know some stories where the families didn't either, but quite often, people who you wouldn't think, you know, who the stereotype would suggest that they would be horrified and they would want to clamp down on it and they would want to say, not in my backyard and all that stuff, and they don't. They don't. They find a way in their heart to expand and accept the little black sheep that wandered into their, you know, into their pen. Oh yeah, I'm so fanciful today. I don't know what that's about. So you have college is essentially a safe place where you can really explore this passion that you're developing in it, and without having to think about, you know, making money from it, getting a job, any of that stuff. But then you do have to graduate.
Mm-hmm.
So what happened?
Well, actually, I was in the middle of my junior year, and I had decided I was going to transfer because the mentor that I loved so much had moved on to a different college, and the acting teachers had changed, and so I just felt like the program had really gone not in the direction I liked anymore. So I auditioned for CCM, since I had conservatory music, and I got accepted, so I was going to transfer there. Our college decided that spring they were going to do a theater tour to do, you know, just to get away, see some Broadway shows. So I had signed up for that. So I went to New York on spring break, and I was so dumb. I walked into Equity, Actors Equity.
He said, here I am.
And I went to audition. And they, you know, of course, asked me for my equity card and union card, and I didn't have it. And they were like, well, they are having auditions right now for this tour of Oklahoma. They may see non-equity at the end of the day. If you want to sit around, there's the lounge over there. You can hang out.
Oh, you're kidding.
I did. So there was about me and about 10 other guys, I guess, who were all non-equity, and we sat there. And then they said, yes, we will see you. So go get changed and come in. I got the job. I got the job.
It was
being stupid and brave at that age. You know, I think back now, like, I would never have the balls to do that today.
Yeah, you know, either that or it was just supposed to be yours.
Right.
You know. Right. Oh my God! So you called home and you said, "Oh, I'm so sorry. I'm not going to school. I'm gonna go on the road."
Yeah, I did.
Unbelievable.
Moved to New York, and thank goodness it happened that way because I was so scared of that big New York City that I probably never would have just gone. But to go with a job already, I mean,
God, Rick, it's an amazing story.
And then to build those friends, you know, I had a little social.
Yeah, no kidding. You
circle then.
Right.
I met on tour and. Those are still some of my best friends today.
Of course, of course. And also, you got what I can't even imagine another circumstance in which you would get is all of those people who went with you, they knew stuff that you needed to know. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean? I mean, I'm assuming this wasn't their first job. This wasn't, am I wrong about this?
Are you talking about from the college or from?
No, I'm talking about the cast.
Oh, yeah. You know. Oh, no, I was definitely the baby of the cast.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
And you suddenly had a lot of teachers.
Yes, true.
You know, that I can't even think of another way you would have gotten. you know?
That's true.
I mean, I suppose you could have met some people at the conservatory that were,
right.
but you landed yet again in this place that was going to propel you, was going to prepare you, was going to tell you about the ropes or whatever,
right.
No?
It's true.
Yeah. It's wonderful.
Yeah. I really feel like my life has been one big wave. I've just kind of ridden it wherever it took
yes.
me, you know?
Yes. I hear it. It's terrific. Okay. So, of course, you started out in the desert. And then somehow you leapt on a wave that
right.
came by on a cart. I don't know, you know?
From Appalachia, Kentucky, straight to New York.
Yes, it's a play, isn't it?
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay, so how long were you on tour, and then what?
I did a lot of touring, especially those early days. I kind of leapt from tour to tour to tour. I did Oklahoma on tour for about a year.
Wow.
And then went straight from that into summer stock, because it really is, I swear, I tell my students today that work gets you work.
Yes.
Because the dance captain who was in Oklahoma had a job as a choreographer for a summer stock, so I didn't even audition. I just got hired into the summer stock, and then while I was doing summer stock, I would go into the city auditioning and got another tour. That's when I did Bessel Horas in Texas, mm-hmm. which I did for 2 years.
Wow.
And then started meeting people and started building resume as a choreographer because I was a dance captain for Bessel Horas. So the first person they go to restage something, like if a regional theater wants to do Bessel Horas, they usually call the dance captain to come in and do it. So while I was working and performing, I was starting to build a resume on the other side. So it kind of...
Again, it's that wave thing, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you're not trying necessarily.
No.
You're just right.
Taking advantage of what
you're
comes.
Sitting in study hall waiting for somebody to come and get you, right?
True.
You know,
that's true.
Right, it's wonderful. Yeah. It's wonderful. Okay, so, and again, also, I mean, I imagine it's hard to argue with success. Your family must have, I mean, I don't think, maybe they didn't have any idea of how extraordinary what had happened to you was, but they certainly must have known that it was a big deal. You were making a living singing and dancing.
Mm-hmm.
No?
Yeah, I mean, of course they wanted me closer, and I mean, that's
yeah.
the mother's lament, I think. They
yes.
want you around and visiting more often and want to make sure you're safe and happy, I guess. But
yeah, but also there some.
Yeah.
That's okay, so knocking around in New York, doing extraordinarily well. What happened?
Well, I kept performing. I did a lot of cruise ships for a while, and a lot of touring companies, some stuff in the city. It's always harder to get to work in New York.
In New York, right.
It seems like every job you get in New York takes you out of New York, of course. Did a lot of regional theater and summer stocks, some off-Broadway, one very brief Broadway flop. I swear it wasn't my fault.
What was it?
It was called A Match Made in Heaven.
Oh, that's a great title.
Yeah. Great experience, but...
Yeah.
And worked in Las Vegas. But all that time, I mean, I also dance captained a tour of Sembra, Sem Brothers, so I get called back in to remount those productions. And then another tour of Oklahoma. I swear I was a dancing cowboy half my life. But eventually I decided I was tired of just choreographing a show because I felt like I was doing so much of the director's work to begin
anyway,
with.
Mm-hmm.
You know? So I started asking some of these places that I had relationships with as coming in as choreographer, could I come back someday and maybe direct for you? So I eventually got into one or two places, and that kind of grew. And again, I'm putting some lines down on my resume as I go. And then started teaching. I started with private studios because a friend was teaching there, you know, and they needed a jazz dance teacher for a day or two, and I would come in, and then, again, work gets you work, you know. They liked what I did there, and they asked me to come back somewhere else.
Yeah, work gets you work if you're something. I mean, work doesn't get everybody work. I mean, I know that. I understand that the theory is correct.
Right.
But you do know the piece that you left out. Right.
Well, I think you have to prove yourself while you're
yes,
there.
Yes, I think that's right. Yeah, right. Okay. All right, so now you're dancing, you're singing, you're performing, you're choreographing, you're directing, and you're teaching. Mm-hmm. Are you still in New York?
Still in New York. And eventually I started weaning myself off the performing side and concentrating more on the directing, choreographing, and teaching.
You can stand still a little bit more, or not?
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, you're still juggling. It always feels like you have five jobs in the air at the same time.
Yeah.
You know, it's not like you have a permanent position anywhere, which is one of the reasons this coming to Bradenton as the artistic director really appealed to me.
So how did that happen?
I was.
Did I leave anything out? I mean, is there something between?
Well, I started teaching a little more exclusively. I was on the faculty at Wagner College. And at American Dramatic Academy in New York, AMDA, Music and Dramatic Academy.
And what were you teaching?
Musical theater and dance classes. And I, while I was doing that, I was also, I worked for the USO for 7 years as their choreographer, and then the last year I was there, got asked to be their entertainment director.
Wow.
So that's what I was doing in New York when I came to vacation in Sarasota. And it was also right after 9/11, and I lived through all of that in New York. And working for the USO during that time, you know, I'd go to work with guys with machine guns right by my desk, and every single show that I did was a deployment for another group of people who we were saying goodbye to, and it was so kind of wearing after a while. And I came to visit a friend that I worked with on a cruise ship. Actually, it was the doctor on board, and owned a house in Sarasota. And actually, Siesta Key.
Oh.
Right down the street. And I just fell in love with it. I mean, I'd toured through here a few times before and always loved it, but just coming here and actually relaxing, I was like, oh, you're so lucky. You live in paradise. Mm-hmm. It's just so wonderful here. And he said, well, if you're really serious, they're looking for an artistic director down the street. Why don't you go talk to them? And I was like, why not?
And you said... Oh, I see a wave.
Exactly. Yeah.
It's so great. So I'm assuming, I mean, you know, you went down and talked to them and you got the job.
Not immediately. They hired a different person that year. They did talk to me a very long time, and I knew they were very serious about me, and I think there were a lot of, I don't know, reasons for their choice, but they hired this lady. So I was disappointed.
Yeah.
But then... less than a year later, they called me and said, we made a mistake. Would you come and take the job, please? So, and I did.
Yeah. And here you are.
And here I am.
So that would have been 2002, like that,
yeah.
2003, yeah. Right. And why don't you just talk about your job there, what it is you do, and what you like about it, and what you would like to have different, or whatever.
My job in particular is to do the hiring of all the artistic staff. If I'm not directing a show myself, I hire the directors or the choreographers, also the designers, the lighting designers, set designers, costume designers, prop masters.
So are you saying for an individual show, or you have those people on staff?
We have a core staff, but we have a technical director, assistant technical director, an electrician, and a production manager. Those are our core staff. Everybody else we job in per show.
Wow.
And
that's great. Yeah. I mean, for the community, it means a lot of people get to work.
It is. And we also hire live musicians, so that's contracted each show. So I kind of see everything that's part of the theater proper and oversee all of that, make sure that we keep our artistic bar pretty high.
Do you choose the shows?
I do, and that has changed since I came, because originally there was a committee of people that...
Oh,
yeah. Everybody had their ideas.
Yeah, I bet.
And finally I convinced our board that, you know...
To stop tearing their hair out.
Well, I was like, you hired me for artistic vision, you know. I think it took a few years for them to trust me with that, but yeah, I think...
It's really interesting. That is actually very interesting, because I would imagine that the board did feel a kind of proprietary interest in, you know, I mean, if you're on that board, you want to, I don't know, you have some interest in the kind of thing that they do.
Right.
So I think it's a big deal that they trusted you and they didn't stop you.
Right.
You know, and they continue to let you do it, right?
That's true, yeah. And the things I love about my job, I mean, I had zero experience in community theater coming in here. Like, my expectations were so low, like a snobby New Yorker walking in, you know. My only kind of window into community theater, I was waiting for Guffman, you know. That's what I thought my life was going to be coming in here. But I am so in love with the idea of community theater. I love the fact that these people are there because they love it and they want to do it. They have a full life already, you know, their jobs, their school, their families, but yet they fit in this enormous commitment.
Yeah.
It's 6 to 8 weeks of rehearsals, 5 nights a week, plus...
For nothing.
And plus we run our shows for 3 weeks. So that's like 3 months of their lives that they're locking up with us. And the fact that they're willing to give that much time and devotion and their talent. I mean, I've always been surprised by the incredibly talented people that live in our area. Mm-hmm. And that the fact that they come share all that with us, I love that. Mm-hmm. And I hope that I'm a little bit of a, that I can kind of live up to what they do, you know, and maybe be a part of sending my passion that I love theater and music so much onto the next generation, or, mm-hmm. you know, sparking that in someone else.
I'm sure you are.
And I love the fact that we have all levels. I mean, every show I do will have... you know, a pro who's been at it. Some of them used to do it professionally, and they mm-hmm. just realized that they'd rather do it for fun.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Others, it's their first time ever. They've never been on stage, but whatever brave, you know, spark they had got them through the door to audition, and they wanted to do it, and discovering something new in themselves. I just love that idea.
Sounds great. Yeah. It really sounds great. Okay. I only ask one more question, and that is, the question simply is, you know, having given a life to this work, which you clearly have, actually, would you just think about it as a whole and say, if there's anything that you would want to say about what that's like, about what it means to dedicate a life to this art, what it felt like, any philosophical position you have on it, any advice, I don't care, just, you know, let it, whatever might occur to you to say about it.
Well, I really think that I feel privileged that somehow somebody somewhere is looking out for me, you know, because the fact that something that I love so much could take me to so many different places, and give me such a joyful life. I mean, I really feel I am so blessed. I really do. Mm-hmm. I mean, and not a lot of people get to wake up every morning and love what they do. You know,
no, that's right.
So I think it's, I'm grateful. A lot of gratitude is there for the arts and what it gives me.
It's a great place to stop. Thank you very much, Rick Kirby.
Thank you.
So this is the reason that I interview people like Rick Kirby. Because you can hear in his story that he allowed himself to be who he is. He allowed himself to discover increasing abilities, increasing interests. He discovered that that he liked to sing. He discovered that he was a natural dancer. He discovered that he could act. He allowed himself to explore and to accept all of who he is, even though each of these discoveries took him further and further away from the boy, the young man, the adult that his family, his community might have wanted him to be, expected him to be, anticipated that he was. He had the courage to be himself. And as I say in this interview, the supportive family is so important to that, and also not necessarily that common. And he keeps discovering, because after all of these years where first he's a singer, then he's a dancer, then he's, you know, a chorus boy, then he's a dance captain, then he's a choreographer, then he's a teacher, and now he's the producing artistic director of a very fine community theater. So it may not even be over yet for Rick, because maybe another wave is coming. He's just going to sit and wait for it to carry him away. There is something in the ability to say yes, to allow yourself to be swept away, to see how that goes. As I said, Rick is a poster child for the Lynn Show, and I am grateful to have been able to interview him. And I also want to tell you that on August 1st and 2nd, the Manatee Players Theater will be premiering a play written by Robin Givens. And this is a one-shot, so if you are near Sarasota or you're going to be in Florida and you want to experience this unusual experience, call the Call the Manatee Players Theater in downtown Bradenton, Florida, or go up on my website, thelynnshow.com, thelynne, don't leave the E out of Lynn, show.com, and click on email me and ask me to give you the telephone number, and I will, because I'm sure that this is going to be a very exciting evening. I need to say that I am so fortunate to live in Sarasota, Florida, where people like Rick and organizations like the Manatee Players Theater, and also in Sarasota, the Players Theater, exist. There are, the talent here, as Rick mentioned, is extraordinary. And the commitment to not only theater, but all of the arts is also extraordinary. I need to thank the amazingly supportive and I could not do without Josh Hackney, who, again, if you've been listening to the show, you know that Josh found the software that I am currently using to talk to you and taught me how to edit on it. And when I forget what he's taught me, he's at the end of a telephone or he rushes down here and he runs me through it again. He built the computer that I am speaking on to and uploaded everything that I need. There's virtually nothing having to do with recording, engineering, computer, that Josh doesn't know or doesn't know how to find. And so if you have need of any of these things, then you want Josh. And you, if you live near here, you can have him in person. If you don't, you can talk to him on the phone the way my clients talk to me on the phone. He can do a lot on the phone, as can I. So, you can get Josh by going up on my website also and asking for Josh. And, well, as always, I hope that you got something from this show that you can use, something that enhanced your life in some way. Maybe it was simply listening to the charming Rick Kirby. Maybe it was having something inside of you stimulated, triggered, some hidden quality or hiding interest that peeked its head out because you heard from someone who really gave himself to himself. Maybe it was just a nice way to spend an hour. In any case, I hope it will be something that will bring you back, because I will be here next week with yet another interesting person, and I sure hope you will be too.
You see, I'm getting older. My hair is turning gray. Always in my face and figure I've both seen better days. Well, I won't be retiring. I won't slip out of sight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I just keep returning like some goddamn boomerang. No, I won't go. My shot, my time has come and gone. Oh, won't I please get off the stage, let someone else get on. Well, I won't be relegated or leave without a fight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a bell I keep on ringing, not a chime that I once rang. You may think it's unseemly. Well, I don't give a dang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Rising from the ashes, every chance I get. I may be running out of time, but it ain't over yet. 'Cause me and Sister Phoenix, we won't give up the flag. No, no, we will not go gentle into that good night. And I won't go with a whimper. Going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I may not be as juicy, hell, but I still got some tang. So you won't